want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for grabbing the latest podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, we'll bring you an update, more information on the incarceration of Roger Shuler. He's being held in the lockup in Columbiana, Alabama, on trumped-up charges of contempt of court and a resisting arrest charge. We're going to continue to cover this case. This podcast will not be restricted to subscribers. We'll make it unrestricted from the get-go. But I always do like to credit the people who make this work possible by subscribing, including Daryl Rotremel, Jason Ferguson, Diane Morris, and John Dickerson, who, well, Diane and John both pay more than the minimum to support my work, and I'm gratified by that. If you haven't subscribed yet, I would invite you to support us because, I need your help to keep it all going. And you can just log on to my website, peterbcollins.com. In the upper left-hand corner, right under my picture, there's a link to sign up. And your options are $1 for a 24-hour pass, $5 a month, or the best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber, I still have a few copies of our bonus book, Spying on Democracy by Heidi Boghossian, and I have some more of that fine kick-ass Kona coffee, and I'll send a bag along to you with your new annual subscription. Find out all the details at peterbcollins.com. Also, you can steer your web business to GoDaddy.com, and they'll pay me a bounty if you take out a new contract with them. For example, right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rates start at just $1.99 a month, and you'll get your domain name free. Follow the link in the show file for this podcast to get a screaming deal at GoDaddy.com. Today we'll update you on the plight of journalist Roger Shuler, currently in jail in the lockup in Columbiana in Shelby County, Alabama. A journalist in jail in violation of the First Amendment.
Oh, Alabama.
And important court ruling precedents.
The devil fools with the best laid plan. Swing low, Alabama. You got the spare chain. You got to feel strange. And now the moment is all that it meant. Alabama, you got the weight on your shoulders.
Yesterday, in a special bulletin podcast, we brought you a conversation with Carol Shuler. She's the wife of blogger-journalist Roger Shuler, who operates the Legal Schnauzer blog in Alabama and has been a longtime contributor to this program related to the Don Siegelman case, many of the dark aspects of the so-called justice system in the Deep South, and in particular in Alabama. And on October 8th, we brought you an in-depth interview with Roger Shuler, which described the developing problems that he was facing because he's been practicing journalism. And by reporting on the private lives that conflict with the public statements and positions of prominent Republicans in Alabama, Roger has drawn the interest of an unusual court situation where a judge has been called out of retirement. A judge with ties to the Riley family, and Rob Riley is the son of the former governor who displaced Don Siegelman, And the younger Riley has been the subject of articles by Roger Shuler, which expose an alleged affair. And Rob Riley has gone to this kangaroo court, is what I call it, because it's not a standing court, and the procedures, such as they have been, don't seem to be consistent with ordinary standards and the expectations that we would have, much less constitutional issues like prior restraint of the activities of a journalist. So as of Friday, noontime here Pacific, this is the 25th of October, Roger Shuler is still being held at the county jail in Columbiana, Alabama. Joining me now is Andrew Craig. He is the founder of the Justice Integrity Project based in Washington, D.C. He has covered these issues in Alabama. He has published articles by Roger Shuler for several years now. And he's also the author of a new book that's on my reading list called Presidential Puppetry. Andrew, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Well, great to be back on the show, particularly with such an important topic.
Well, it truly is. And while you and I know Roger Shuler and we care about his situation, we don't want to see him languish behind bars. There are important, significant national issues here about suppression of First Amendment rights. And before we get into that, I want to both compare notes here and update our listeners on what we have learned since my first podcast about this about 24 hours ago. And let me ask you first, Andrew, because you have been working with me and other people to provide legal support to Roger Shuler at this critical time, and also to see if it's possible to bail him out of jail at this point. Now, as we disclosed yesterday, Shuler was picked up on alleged contempt charges, which you and I will discuss in a bit, and which we find to be weak at best. But he also has been accused of resisting arrest. And in a moment, I'll share what Carol Shuler, Roger's wife, told me about the details of the altercation or the encounter that led to his arrest. But you have been also working to try to win his release on bail. So let's start there. What is the status of Roger's incarceration?
Well, the status is false hope on his part that if the $1,000 bail can be met on his resisting arrest charge, he could get out. I just talked to the bail bondsman's office, which, you know, deals with these kind of situations every few minutes, I suppose, as opposed to a prisoner who's never been arrested. And they said what Roger doesn't know is that there's two contempt of court charges pending with no bond. Mm-hmm. And so the judge could hold him in jail indefinitely. And if it's kangaroo court, they probably will. And so Roger is waiting to get out for the weekend. His wife is totally confused. She's at home without internet, without money, and she's worried about being arrested if she steps a foot out the door herself on contempt charges, which are bogus because they're holding her responsible for everything that he does when he's the blogger. She's the wife.
Right, and that's a very important fundamental here. They have overcharged the Shulers because Roger writes the blog, and while his wife may be fully supportive of it, she's not the journalist here. She's not the one who has investigated and published these articles. And so it's just another heavy-handed legal maneuver on the part of Rob Riley and his attorneys.
Well, it's not just them, although they're central figures in this, but as Roger has documented for years and you've reported for years, this is a very common tactic by prosecutors because in one of the major cases, particularly down there in Mississippi that we've all reported on, they charge husband and wife, and then they go to you know, the couple and says, look, you know, your children are going to be totally damaged if you both go to prison for a long time. And in this case, which is the Oliver Dias case, mm-hmm. that I think you know.
Yeah, I've spoken. He's a former justice in Mississippi.
Supreme Court judge, and he yeah. and his wife said, we're both innocent. And they said, no, you're not. We're bringing you to trial, and but if you plead guilty, then we'll let your wife go. And he is one of the very few people, maybe because he's a former Supreme Court judge and maybe because he was totally innocent, who went through two trials and was acquitted. But it was this dragnet approach of bring in the wife. So sorry for a long story, but I wanted to be very specific that this is a tactic mm-hmm. used elsewhere.
Right.
And that's why we've got to pay attention, even people who don't know about Roger Shuler and his wife, to these kinds of situations when they're totally blatant and documented.
Mm-hmm. And Carol is rightfully concerned. For example, she hasn't attempted to visit Roger. He's spent now two nights in jail, and she is concerned that she might be locked up as well if she gives the authorities any opportunity. So that's a very realistic concern on her part. The other details that I got from a conversation with Carol this morning came from her conversation with Roger in jail, and it's more details on the manner in which he encountered the authorities and was taken into custody. And this occurred on Wednesday evening, the 23rd of October, at about 6 p.m. local time. And as Carol described it, one police car kind of zoomed up as Roger had opened the garage door remotely and was starting to move his car toward it. And this police car kind of came in at an angle, and the officer got out. Roger said, hey, you almost hit my car. What on earth are you doing here? And at that point, Roger managed to get his car into the garage. Then, as Carol relates it, the officer said, hey, why don't you come outside? And Roger declined that invitation. And at this point, and apparently at no point, was there the mention of an arrest warrant or a search warrant. According to Carol, that was not produced by this officer or the others who shortly joined him. So as the narrative continues, Carol says that Roger started to move through the garage up some steps toward the kitchen. And at that point, the officer grabbed him, knocked over some boxes. She described the officer as wailing on Roger, and also that mace was used to subdue him. And I want to underscore that the lack of presentation of any authority in the form of an arrest warrant or other document is problematic here, and we'll certainly explore this with Roger the next time we get a chance to talk to him. Carol went on to say that three more officers joined. There were threats to break Roger's arms. He was roughed up as they put him in a squad car. There are injuries to his right knee. He sustained cuts and bruises. You have published, Andrew, in the article on your site that I will link to in the podcast file for this show, a booking photo of Roger, which shows some puffing of the face and, in particular, around his eyes. When I asked Carol about that, she said that it was most likely a byproduct of the application of mace. She's not aware that he was actually struck in the face. But again, these details are not complete. Andrew, is there anything that you have picked up that you'd like to add to that description?
Well, I think it's a very thorough description. I heard the essence of it. I think it's quite valuable that you're recording it in such detail, Peter. As I look at my notes, I'd have hard time reconstructing it with such detail, but everything that you said, Carol told me as well. And I think the specifics here are very important that, you know, he was in his garage, arguably part of the house, and no presentation of a warrant and authority. And what we're moving to take it to a larger plane with these kind of details, is truly a kind of police state mentality that starts in places like Alabama against people that they don't like, you know, reporter types, and expands to other parts of the population. And Radley Balco has just written a book on this, but many of us have, I think he calls it the militarization of the police, you know.
Right.
You know, it's becoming in violation of the longstanding posse comitatus law, which ironically came about in the South and in Congress and throughout the country, that you can't use the military. It came about after Reconstruction. But we're seeing police, whether it's military tactics or just this roughhouse return to old-time law, they just do what they want. And we've got to pay attention to this, because we hear about this because we know about Roger Shuler, but it starts with some people and extends to many more.
And I have used the term kangaroo court in my coverage, and I think it's quite justified here. Because, Andrew, when we look at what is occurring in the life of Roger and Carol Shuler and how this has originated, there doesn't seem to be a step in this process that conforms to what you and I consider standards of justice. And so we start with this retired judge who's called out of retirement and ordered by Justice Moore, the guy who is most famous outside Alabama for installing the Ten Commandments at the courthouse. And Moore calls this judge, Claude Nielsen, into, you know, some sort of special. It's unclear to me whether he is a visiting judge in an established court or whether this is just, you know, kind of justice out of the back of his car or out of his briefcase. At any rate, he has heard one-sided testimony from Rob Riley and his alleged paramour, and they have denied the allegations that Roger Shuler has published. But that has no weight. There's been no finding of defamation. There simply has been an allegation by parties who claim to be injured. They've offered no proof of malice or the other elements that need to be present in established precedent, related to defamation and libel cases. And so from the start, this is a process that seems well outside the law.
Well, it's very important, particularly in this case, but also it's fascinating from both an activist, a legal, and other historical perspective, to realize that this is a kind of mirror image of the litigation that over 50 years ago enabled the civil rights movement and freedom of the press in the United States. So that's a big mouthful, but let me describe why. In the early civil rights struggle, you know, people could have sit-ins and this, so on and so forth, but if nobody heard about it, all would happen is they'd get beaten up, the demonstrators, and ignored. So the national media started covering this. And in places, literally Alabama, nearby, and other Deep South states, they'd have these libel trials against newspapers from the North that would cover the civil rights struggle. And there were nearly $300 million in libel judgments by kangaroo court juries, all white juries, against newspapers and reporters and civil rights demonstrators in the early 60s when the Supreme Court took an Alabama $500,000 libel verdict against the New York Times and said, look, you know, we're not going to have free press, we're not going to have civil rights, we're not going to have anything here if this defamation kangaroo court stuff goes on. I mean, I'm an attorney, and I don't normally use these language here, but I'm in a legal papers. But that's what it was, Peter. As you pointed out.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 in a famous case, New York Times versus Sullivan. Sullivan was police commissioner of Montgomery, Alabama, and they just threw out the libel stuff. And they articulated the standards that you mentioned of, when dealing with a public figure like the Riley family, I mean, the most powerful political family in Alabama, you've got to show what's called absolute actual malice, not mm-hmm. absolute actual malice.
And isn't the language malice aforethought? That's
yeah,
what.
Yeah. So they got to prove that you either knew it was wrong or you had reckless disregard of whether it's right mm-hmm. or wrong. Now, Roger Shuler, just to underscore some of his credentials, University of Missouri graduate. I didn't go there, but it's, in my mind, the top journalism school in the country. He worked 13 years for the largest daily newspaper in the morning in Alabama. And even though he's very hard-hitting and extreme, particularly in getting into some of these sex cases, it's my belief he's very thorough and backs it up. And if I could, let me just talk a little bit for a second about mm-hmm. some of the sex stuff here. First of all, I'm the first to argue and advocate with my fellow investigative reporters that unless you're in the hotel room on sex cases or at the national security meeting, we don't know what's going on. And if we are in the national security meeting or the hotel room, we probably can't be talking about it. So all of this, we got to bear in mind, it might not be true what we report. But particularly in some of these Alabama sex cases, my 6 or 7 years of in-depth investigation illustrates to me that it's not just about the sex. It's one, the hypocrisy, because they're all family values, elected on family value platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it's vastly more behavior. You know, I don't know about this case, but I can just say from my other in-depth reporting, it's a power thing. I mean, they're constantly doing things that they shouldn't be in the sexual realm. And finally, the most important thing is that my reporting indicates, as does Rogers and other people who dare get into this, that it is connected with public policy, because it's ultimately about crony capitalism steering government programs and other government policies toward your own buddies, and in a way that will not withstand the light of day. And what better way to do it than to get your sexual partners involved and people that you're blackmailing and all kinds of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because this cannot stand the light of day. And when you have, like in the Siegelman case, missing court files and all of these crazy procedures, and then you find out that the presiding judge is running secretly a company that gets $300 million in
no bid federal contracts. Yes.
Yeah. And I misspoke. He wasn't running it, but he was the 44% shareholder.
Right. And that is Mark Fuller, by the way,
Mark Fuller,
name on it. Uh-huh.
Chief federal judge. And he was having an affair with his court clerk when 50 irregularities were going on as the prosecution and Fuller were framing the Siegelman. It's very important that he was sleeping with his married court clerk, and we know this because of two things. You know, the divorce actions
mm-hmm.
that Roger Shuler is one of the few people to have guts enough to report, and then they seal the divorce papers. And so Roger and I filed with the clerk in this other case saying, you know, there's Alabama Supreme Court law. You can't seal this case. They don't care. Peter.
Well, and this is important because, Andrew, I'm sympathetic to your position. I don't like to explore the private lives of people. And you know, frankly, if you have an active polyamorous sex life, in general, it's not my business. But there is this incredible pattern of corruption and the cover-up of, improper behavior by these corrupt people in very key positions of power. And so it is that pattern that Roger has been pursuing. And I was astounded at the full frontal nude picture of Judge Pryor. But when you look at it in context with, Pryor's homophobic representations in his court rulings and in public statements, then, you know, I consider this to be a fair issue for a reporter to explore. Now, that said, we still have a situation where this retired Judge Nielsen has issued an injunction without hearing one word of argument from Roger Shuler or advocates for his position, without any evaluation of the reporting that Shuler has done. The judge issued this injunction, which not only orders him to take down all posts related to Rob Riley and Liberty Duke, but it prohibits him from any further coverage. And those two issues of ordering the removal of published materials, absent any finding of defamation or libel, at least not in any legal way, linked to this prior restraint of an illegal order that Shuler may not cover these individuals in the future. This is red flags to the top of the pole.
Well, it is, and here's a third element, which is to seal the court file.
Yeah.
So nobody else can cover it.
Right.
And so if Shuler obeys and removes it and the court file is sealed, then it didn't happen. It's news that didn't happen. It's gone down the memory hole. We need Winston Smith from 1984 vanished from the face of the earth.
Well, but Andrew, I mean,
to do.
But who are they kidding? All right, they have no reach to me to order me to take down the podcast that I've recorded with Roger Shuler that cover the same material. And
well, there are logistical difficulties, but only because Roger did not immediately comply.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he had immediately complied, then, you know, a few scattered items, you know, they can live with embarrassment because they are the power structure. And I use the analogy, if I feel too big for my britches, of, you know, we're the peasants throwing stones at the castle while the duke's in the castle, protected by the moat and the walls and the guards and the sheriff's deputies. You know, they're laughing at the feast and say, well, you know, the peasants are not happy today. We'll take care of them tomorrow.
Well, somebody ought to tell Rob Riley about the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive, because
that's true, and I don't mean to be discouraged, but I think from watching these people, they're willing to take a few punches to wipe it off, wipe him out, and wipe off his pesky reporting. And, you know, his wife told me he's going nuts in jail now. Wait till it's 3 months from now.
Right. Well, and let's focus on that for a moment, because as I raised with Carol Shuler in my conversation with her that we podcasted yesterday, my concern is that these contempt charges really are at the discretion of the judge. And as you pointed out in your article, Roger, a few months ago, wrote about a woman who was found in contempt in a divorce case. And ultimately, the judge was disciplined for that, but possibly for the wrong, you know, motivation. So, you know, contempt is something that gives, remarkable unchecked power to a court. And I don't know the standing of this judge and this court, as I've expressed, but any legal action, even if it were initiated today, could take weeks to produce a hearing that then produces some finding that could either overturn the contempt citation on appeal or produce some compromise that would lead to Roger Shuler's release. But in my own experience with the Josh Wolf case here in California, and briefly, Josh Wolf was an independent videographer who shot footage of a protest in San Francisco where a San Francisco Police Department car was torched. And because they claimed that car had been paid for in part by federal funds, they called that a federal crime. And he ended up serving more than 6 months in a federal lockup in Pleasanton, California, on contempt charges related to this wobbler. I mean, it was never a federal case to begin with. It didn't belong in the federal courts, but that's where it landed. And it was because there is a somewhat effective journalist shield law on the books in California. And so in order to bypass that and put pressure on Josh Wolf, they moved him into federal court. So that's a bit of a lengthy explanation, but fundamentally, these contempt charges could leave Roger behind bars for a long time.
Well, and here's a difference, and without knowing all the legal facilities available to Josh Wolf, but one of the things Carol just told me that's in my article on the Just Integrity Project site is she said, you know, I'm stuck in my house with no food, no money, no internet, and if I step out of the house, I could be arrested too. And they may even bash down the doors. And so they have no lawyer, they have no money, and except for phone calls to her, no communication. And so who is there to defend the guy except something like this radio show and you know, people using the internet and so forth, and here's two specific things about Alabama and this kind of one party autocracy that they have there that's actually spreading in other states, certainly Texas and Mississippi, but elsewhere. Is the main newspapers are on 3-day-a-week programs. Mm-hmm. You know, they cut down the staffs. The reduced staffs, you know, they mostly just get handouts from the prosecutors. They don't want to get into this stuff. So, you know, who is there? The newspapers aren't going to do it. Lawyers. Well, they've got a very interesting legal provision there in the bar. You cannot criticize a judge and be a lawyer in Alabama, or they'll haul you right up and your license will be in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. They, you know, all of the kind of things that we've documented for years, they're never going to look into that stuff. But if you're a lawyer and you criticize a judge, they'll get you. So if you got the newspapers and lawyers are out of commission, then you got the national newspapers that are heavily reliant on the wire services. And as someone who covered federal courts for 5 years full-time for a mainstream daily, the Hartford Courant, and also as a former clerk to a federal judge, I know a lot about how this court coverage works. And for most of the country, they rely on wire service reports from the main newspapers to understand what's going on in Alabama.
Right.
So a place like the Washington Post, which I've tried to get interested in the Siegelman case for years, they couldn't care less. And what they're doing is rewriting, no matter what happens, little stories from the Alabama papers that are totally under the thumbs of the kind of Riley family that we're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. So what the heck is anybody supposed to know or do except for shows like yours, Peter?
Well, we're going to keep pushing, and you know, people are learning about this. I've gotten 5 or 6 emails from people in Alabama asking us to continue the coverage. They know there's a blackout locally, and they are hungry for information and for justice, as you might suspect. And we'll just keep making noise about this and doing what we can. I want to focus a little bit on the details that you've published in your article, Andrew, about this retired circuit court judge, Claude Nielsen, and the manner in which he was put in charge of this case. It smacks of cronyism and insider cover-ups of Republican leaders, one for the other.
Well, I've poked around on that, but of course, you know, they don't announce anything except, you know, the barest details. He's in charge. Well, who is he? Well, he's apparently, by law, he's got to retire. So he's retired. But what powers? So the head of the Supreme Court, this Roy Moore, who flouted the U.S. Supreme Court, and even mm-hmm. an arch-conservative like William Pryor, the Attorney General, said, ruled you can't do this. You can't just flout the Supreme Court law. But they're on a mission, and a mission from God, to, you know, literally in the case. He wants the Ten Commandments there, and it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. So he's the chief judge. He appoints Claude Nielsen, who's from another part of the state. He's not even from the Birmingham area. So they're bringing him in under who knows what authority to handle this case. And Nielsen went to school at the University of Alabama in the mid-60s, right when Bob Riley, the father of the plaintiff, mm-hmm. was going to school there. And I've poked around a little bit there. I don't yet know if they knew one another, but my understanding from one of my sources, who is an old-time good source who went to the University of Alabama, says, don't think of it as, you know, 30,000 people, national football championship team, big school. You know, nobody could afford to go to college then. It's 5,000 people. And if it's a 5,000-person university, you do kind of the math, you know, with graduate mm-hmm. professional schools, it's probably about 600 people in a class, okay. And ambitious politicos probably knew one another. I don't know that, though. Mm-hmm. So it stinks.
And you haven't been able to discover, and I don't think I have either, but I raised the question earlier, is he, you know, presiding over a local superior court? You know,
it's a circuit court, but if he's brought back for one case, that's judge shopping. And if he's not elected, but forced into retirement, you would think, I mean, I work for a very fair judge, and he was, you know, he bent over backwards to make sure everybody's happy. And in fact, he had a big mafia case, Peter, the Whitey Bulger case, when I was law uh-huh. clerk. And I'd written about the mafia, and I was his law clerk, and he called in the mafia people and the Justice Department and showed them my stories and said, are you comfortable with this law clerk? And that's the way things should be. And it's not, oh, who do I know in the entire state of Alabama who might be a good judge for this case of my fellow Republican against this journalist who's always criticizing the court system? Oh, Claude Nielsen. I'll get him to do it. He'll do a good job. Mm-hmm. What the heck is that?
So then we have Nielsen impaneled in an unknown office of the judiciary. He is petitioned by Rob Riley and Liberty Duke. They present these sworn statements that they have never been naked with each other or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And he then issues an injunction. Then we have the matters that we've covered before in detail in the October 8th interview with Roger Shuler about the faulty efforts to serve the Shulers with these defective legal instruments, the injunction and an order to appear. And Shuler shrugged those off and filed a motion to quash. We have no indication that that motion has been heard or dismissed or acted on in any way. And then in short order, we have the events of this past Wednesday, where Shuler was picked up, and I underscore that to our knowledge, there was no reference to or presentation of a warrant. He was simply grabbed by the cops and taken to jail. And so from beginning to end, we have a air quote process that is riddled with defects and with one-sided operation favorable to the Riley plaintiff here. And this cannot withstand any sort of outside scrutiny. So, as you pointed out, they put it under seal, hoping to essentially make it off limits. None of this, I think, is tenable long term. But meantime, Roger Shuler is rotting in the jail in Columbiana.
Well, that's a great summary. In a certain sense, that's the story of the Siegelman prosecution, who's rotting in jail in Louisiana, where they wanted to put him to keep him away from family and people in Alabama, and lots of other people. And just to broaden this a little bit, we're talking about somebody we know, and they're middle class, and we're Siegelman's middle class. There's 2 million people in prison, and probably most of them, like most people, have done something bad, and most of them have done something real bad. But we've got procedures for a reason here, and it seems that if they go out the window, particularly for high-profile individuals, that it's obvious misconduct, what the heck is going on the rest of the time that we don't have time to follow?
Yeah, that's a very important point. And as you alluded earlier, Andrew, there are fewer reporters and less media coverage, even if they choose to be objective about these issues, which is not a given. So,
one other quick point is, I'm very involved in journalism circles, and it's not just that they don't have time; they've got deadlines and everything. But what we've seen is the end of a kind of long process of self-selected, people who go along with the program remain in the job. Other people who ask the tough questions, they're weeded out. People don't seem to get along with you at your beat. We got to have some layoffs, and you're one of them. So it's a self-selected process to keep many of the most timid and craven and, go along with the program type of people in this job. And that, I know you had another question, but I'll just mention that the takedown of Dan Rather and some other people, including Roger Shuler, mm-hmm. is a very important part of this process, because what it does is it says to the remaining reporters, we know you're worried about your job, and look what we just did to Dan Rather and Roger Shuler, so you better understand that it'd be a lot easier if it didn't take you out.
Yeah, and that leads to self-censorship, and there are many other factors that play into that as well. So, yeah, my final question is just if you want to add anything that we haven't touched on so far.
Well, it's a very important interview, and I encourage your listeners to retweet it and get out the word. My Justice Integrity Project is establishing a legal fund for Roger Shuler, although people could more directly just go to his website, which is Legal Schnauzer, and he's got a PayPal there. That's mm-hmm. probably the easiest way to do it, although neither he nor his wife can access it right now in this minute, they don't have internet, and he's in jail.
Yeah.
But, this extremely important fight, because without the Roger Shulers of the world, the light goes out for many, many other victims, particularly in the Deep South, but nationally, we've got to show that this kind of journalism cannot be crushed by a jail cell and a beaten-up reporter.
Andrew Craig from the Justice Integrity Project, thanks for being there for Roger and for fighting for our own First Amendment rights and a decent media in this country. And we will continue this fight and continue to update our listeners.
Thank you.
There's a journalist in jail. We're going to stay on this story until Roger Shuler is free. Please share this podcast.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until